Okay, today I'm in Torquay with Dave Phillips. Thanks very much for agreeing to talk to us today, Dave.
Yeah, welcome, Simon.
So, ex-chairman of Torquay United, a
Yes.
magistrate, former
Yes.
racecourse trainer, pioneer and bookmaker, and one of the oldest still active. Have I missed anything?
I think you probably covered it mainly, Simon. Yeah, whether I'm the oldest active, I'd probably doubt that, but I'm one of them, certainly. 75 years of age, so yeah. I mean, there's other firms that have been going longer than I have in 50 years, but probably the descendants are acting now, not the actual original proprietor of the firm.
Okay, so you've been a bookmaker, like I say, 50 years. But one of your first experiences of a bookmaker wasn't a happy one. You got knocked by a firm called PTS. I had an account with them for £750 after getting the jackpot up. What happened there?
Well, the story in those days, I was very friendly with another bookmaker called Matt Green, Trevor Green, his real name. He trades under Matt Green. We were quite keen punters in the mid-60s, and we weren't bad. And one of these days, it was at Ascot at a jumps meeting in February, and we sat down on Torquay seafront and went right through the card. And we did a perm because this firm called PTS, Postal Turf Services of Epsom, the jackpot in those days was a 5 shilling stake. So we did it to, I think it was a shilling stake, 5p, whatever. Did a perm. We had a 33-1 winner involved in it. It was ridden by Richard Pittman, trained by Verley Buicks. The old timers remember these names. And anyway, it went right through. It came to the last race, and we covered everything so far. And the last race was an odds-on favourite, and we left it out. And we put a horse in called Rural Gamble. Never forget it. It was ridden by Stan Mellor, and it won. So we copped it. And at that time, we were listening to the tannoy in one of Jack Bevan's betting shops in Torquay, and we were like, "Yes, got it!" And it paid £1,500 for a shilling stake. So, bearing in mind this was in February 68, I was due to get married in 3 weeks after that, March 68. So, £750 each to Matt Green and myself, and was a lot of money. I mean, average wages in those days would have been less than £20 a week, you know. So, £750, honeymoon paid for, the wedding, the lot. Anyway, at that time in our jobs, Trevor Green and myself were both working as telephonists at the old GPO. These days it's BT that run everything. In those days it was the GPO. And so we got a letter back from Postal Services with a form to fill out. "Are you a member or do you work for the GPO?" We thought, "Oh, Christ, you know." We thought, "Yeah, we do, but it's got nothing. What's that got to do with anything?" So the mistake we made, instead of lying and just saying no, we went to a solicitor and said, "What do we do about this?" And he didn't know anything about racing or betting or anything. And he went, "You have to tell the truth." Yeah, so we put, "Yes, we are telephonists at the GPO." Got a letter back within a few days. "There's your stake back. Sorry, not paying. There's our rules." So it was like despondency all round. There you are. That was a, yeah, what can you say? It was a, I wouldn't say a lesson learned, but yeah, I mean, terms and conditions. Probably it was in their terms and conditions. Any member of the post office were not eligible to bet with us. And of course, all these days with them were postal turf services. It was sent through, you know, letter. And by the way, after that, when we were working at the GPO, we had the post office investigators come and investigated us and gave us rigorous interviews to say we were, "What are you up to? We don't believe anyone could do this, get this jackpot thing." So, yeah, we could do it. You know, we're absolute students of form. I believe you put a 33-1, but no one, well, it had a chance, you know, and we got cleared because we were not guilty of anything. But they, you know, it was a lot of distrust at the time.
Yeah, so you still got knocked.
Still got knocked.
So, but you eventually became a racecourse bookmaker. So when did that happen, and how come you decided that was the game?
Well, Matt Green and I decided that we used to go racing a lot in the local tracks at Newton Abbot and Exeter, and sort of loved the colour of the excitement, just like the feel of it. So we thought, well, we wouldn't mind having a go at this. And spoke to a few people, and we always got sort of put off. No, it's not for you, not for you, da da da. But then we were quite keen. So we applied to the Devon and Cornwall BPA. It was a BPA in those days. It was Bookmakers Protection Association. It's now Bookmakers Associations. And they said, okay, well, yeah, all right, you have to come for an interview. I think it was at the Grand Hotel or something in Torquay, and there was a big round table with about 12 on their committee and firing questions at us. And I think one of the questions that were asked, they said, what if somebody has a fiver at 13 to 8, how much are you going to pay them? I think it's £8, 12 and a half pence. No, I may be wrong on that. But I said, 6 to 4 and a bit more. Didn't have really... But anyway, Leslie Redfern, who was the uncle of Anthea Redfern, there was Redferns were a monopoly in Torquay at the time, and there was about five bookmaking brothers. And he's the uncle of Anthea, as I say. And he said, well, how much capital are you starting with? And I think Matt Green and I had about 150 quid each, which seemed a lot of money at the time. I said, well, we've got £300. He said, do you realise that you can lose it in the first race? I said, oh, God, no. Yeah, but anyway, that's they accepted our application anyway, so that's where it's all started.
Okay, because you had options at the time. Just briefly, you were also a promising footballer and qualified as a football coach.
Yeah, I mean, I was a good schoolboy footballer. I'd never really made the grade after that, but I was keen on coaching, and I'd got an FA coaching badge, and then attended a course at Lillishaw in Shropshire and got a coaching badge. Got to know a chap called Tony Waiters, who was an England goalkeeper at the time, and I said, I wouldn't mind a future in this business. He said, yeah, he said, you're probably not being a professional, you wouldn't get a job here, but I can sort you out with a job in New Zealand as a sort of part-time player coach with a job. I said, yeah, sounds great, you know, and that was, you know, I was fully intended to do that at one time.
So you decided to take the plunge as a bookie, you and Trevor as a joint partnership to begin with?
We were called, we were an amalgamation of our names, and we were called Dave Green to start with. Yeah, that was November 1970.
So you just had to put your name down for pitches or put any money up?
Didn't have to put money up in those days. You applied for pitches. Some of them were easier to get, usually the ones that are useless. For instance, the Midlands, you could get a lot of pitches in the Midlands, mainly in the Silver Rings. Well, you had to start in the Silver Ring. You couldn't start in Tattersalls or the Rails. It had to be the cheaper rings, you know, and do a 12-month probationary period, if you like.
Right, so you were forced to do an apprenticeship as such in the old days.
Yeah, right? Which is fairly sensible, you know.
So your first the first pitch you actually got was in at Leicester. Quite a long way from Torquay.
Yeah, I mean, this was sort of exciting times. We got this letter through. You've been approved to bet at the Leicester Silver Ring from now, you know. So the next meeting was in November 1970. So Trevor Green and I fixed up accommodation, made sure we got all the right tools. I think we called it in Bristol on the way. A chap called Skylines used to do the... some sort of equipment, an umbrella. I think we needed an umbrella. We were to buy that, and we went up there, and we turned up with all our gear, trooped into the course and the Silver Ring, and I think all the Midland bookmakers just couldn't believe it. They said, "Where are you from?" I said, "From Devon, Torquay." I went, "Are you serious? This is like a Monday in November at Leicester. You can imagine." And it was a two-day meeting, so we went to both days. And after the £300 capital, I think we went home with our tail between our legs with about 200 quid. So that was a one and gone right away.
So how did you, who learned to clerk then? Did you learn on the job somewhere?
We got taught by a few different people. I think one of them was a chap called Roy Bicknell, who Paul Bicknell is his nephew, who used to work for me for quite a few years. He knew the business, and another chap called Barney of Newquay, who worked for his brother Les Fern, clerked for Harry Metcalf, the Jack Bevan firm, for many years. Yeah, they taught us the rudiments of clerking. Yeah, and of course all the figures in those days were down in shillings and pence. You know, there was no pounds mentioned. Never got that far.
So when did you? So you've done most of your tanking. When did you? Did you not think about turning it in there and then, or did you?
Yeah, I mean, we struggled on from then, went to the Boxing Day meeting, didn't even win there. One of the problems, I think we were more punters, really, and, we fancied horses, and So that led, actually, we never had a fallout, Matt Green and I, but we both had opinions. And, you know, one's going to be right, one's going to be wrong. One fancies the favourite, the other one doesn't. So on the way home, somebody's going to be right, somebody's going to be wrong. So he decided to go on his own back. But before then, we attended Newton Abbot on Easter Monday, 1971. And it was in the middle of the course there now, which they don't bet there now. And I think the stakes were, minimum stakes were 4 shillings, 20p. Filled up the columns. It was like massive. And at the end of the day, we looked at won every race and we netted after expenses £155, which average wages then were 20 quid a week. So I thought, wow, this is the game. That sort of changed my outlook about, you know, football and things. And I thought, I think we'll concentrate on the bookmaking side of things.
Okay, so back in those days, when you applied for a pitch, you had to qualify to actually get it. How did that work?
Yeah, you had to do let me think now, it's coming back a bit, you had to do, I think it was 75% of all meetings. I mean, some of them were desperate, but and there's a number of bookmakers who actually didn't qualify. They were called casuals, and they and of course if anyone come in after them and did qualify, they'd jump over them. So it was quite important in the early days to qualify if you could. And that's what, you know, that's what I intended to do.
Okay, so you started your life as a racecourse bookmaker, as a just on the list sort of, you know, bookmaker.
Mm.
You're looking for clashes, and Yom Kippur was always a big day.
Yeah, right. I'm not sure what time of year it is. My Jewish friends would probably tell me, but when Yom Kippur occurred, serious Jewish people, it was a religious holiday, and virtually the front lines of the London tracks were empty. So everyone got a move up. And yeah, you wouldn't miss those days. You ended up with a very good pitch instead of a bad one.
And you said that you and Trevor were both opinionated. So did you have to be a good judge and an opinionated bookmaker to survive in those pitches in those days? Or could you make books as such?
No, I think in the bad pitches, it was impossible to make books. You had to have some sort of sway and an opinion. And yeah, I was a pretty keen form student, so I had lopsided books. I mean, but that's the way it was, you know. In bad pitches, it was impossible.
Okay, now who would have been the kingpin bookies back in the day when you started? You would have looked up to or been in awe of?
Well, I mean, bearing in mind the silver ring, there wasn't really any kingpins. When you went into the main rings, as it happened, there's Stephen Little. Started virtually probably about 3 or 4 months after me, because I know I was always just in front of him on the list. And he used to turn up, well, he's quite well established in it, that he used to turn up on his bike and with his big fur coat. And it was quite strange because he used to be quite what they call a fiddler, really. And all of a sudden it seemed to turn into he's taking 10 grand bets, you know. But he was obviously the king of the ring. I mean, he was allegedly the biggest bookmaker in the world. A bit tricky betting next to him, although he never pulled the odds too much. You know what I mean? He was quite fair, and but big punters knew they could get on.
Talking of big punters, who would have been any names you can pull out the hat for back in those days?
Not really. They didn't. They just certainly didn't come to me. They would have gone to Little, but a lot of the Little's clients were, I mean, it was supposed to have been Manus and Tabor and all that. I mean, I don't know. And Stephen never disclosed any secrets like that, so I wouldn't know. But, I mean, we had the regular punters like Eddie Lachue, who's still around now, obviously, and Dodger McCartney, who was always a jolly sort of chap. And, yeah, I mean, there was a few characters around. Johnny Lights used to bet in the London tracks. Seemed to get some good information from somewhere along the lines.
Okay, Dave, by the 1980s, you'd moved up and got pitches at Royal Ascot and Cheltenham. What happened? Did a load of bookies die?
Well, unfortunately, in the business in those days, it was dead man's shoes. The only way you could go up the line, and everyone would put their head down and say, I'm really sorry to hear about that. And secretly, they're saying, I've got to bloody move up. Oh, they're a sad lot. Yeah, that's the way it worked. And I think it was Only 76, the first appearance at Royal Ascot. Strangely enough, the first race, and Matt Greenberg will remember this if he sees this this film, this video. The first three got disqualified. Unbelievable. The first race at Royal Ascot, first race we ever bet on. And Ryan Price, either, I think he had the winner, but got disqualified. And we bet each one odds on. We had three odds on horses in the after the race. And the fourth horse got it. So it was a hell of a start. And Royal Ascot in those days was, there was no ticket only. I mean, on Gold Cup day, that must have been 80,000 people there. There was no limit. The business was fantastic, you know.
And would the business have been fantastic, you know, everywhere? Was it still difficult a lot of places?
Well, in those days, it would only be for bad pitches. It would only be any good if there was a clashing meeting, to be honest with you. For instance, there may be a Newbury and an Ascot on the same day, which would split the books up. And you'd get a very good move up to a good pitch. And that make a big difference, you know. It's a chalk and cheese business, you know, betting in the back lines as the front lines. You know, they'll go to a bookmaker's at 6-4 in the front. You could be 7-4, and they ignore you. That's the way it is. You know, pitches are paramount in the business.
And when you started to move up the list, did you start to realise what life was like on the other side?
Oh, absolutely. You know, this I thought, God, you know, I can't believe how good this is. But those were the days. And pitches were everything. You had to have a good pitch.
So also during that time, mid-80s, if I'm correct, you made it to president of the Devon and Cornwall Bookmakers Association. So it's like 15 years after that intimidating interview at the Grand Hotel or wherever it was. Mm. How did you manage to fly up the ranks that quickly?
I don't really know. I mean, probably there's not much opposition. But I think Harry Metcalf was chairman and president of the Devon and Cornwall Bookmakers for many, many years, and always put up a good show. He was a good front man for everything, Harry. I may have been vice president for a while, and then he decided to retire. And I think there may have been somebody in between, but I can't remember. But I took over, and I was quite proud to be there. And funnily enough, it was only just recently I found out that one of my predecessors back in the 40s was a chap called Billy Kember, I think he's called. Apparently, he was one of the characters in the Peaky Blinders series. And this is all new. And I only just recently found this out. And he retired to Torquay and lived in a place called Park Hill Road, a road called Park Hill Road, and died in Torquay, and apparently left a lot of money. And he was president of Devon and Cornwall Bookmakers.
Did he ever share with Bevan?
I saw, strange enough, I saw on a Twitter thing or something the other day, it was said, this is the East Cornwall point-to-point, it's 1949. And number one pitches were Bevan and Kimber. So I don't know if the Bevan firm would like to admit to that now.
So you've been in that role, you would have been on the appeals committee, if there's any grievances or any...
Yeah.
So have you got any fond recollections of any of them?
Well, there was a lot of stuff that went on, mainly about the lists in those days. The Southern BPA, which was the London Tracks, were notorious for favouring their own members and leaving out the bumpkins from other places that they sort of kept them down as far as they could. And there was a number of appeals, but then in those days, of course, there was only sons at one time that could take up. If a father died and a son was in the business, he could take over the pictures. No daughters or wives or anything like that, just sons. And there was a case, and I won't mention any names, but there was a chap who appealed in the southern region. He was both London based, that everyone thought this chap was his grandson, but he turned out it was his son. But I won't go into the sordid details, but there was a bit of both involved there. But he had an affidavit from a solicitor to say, no, I'm his son, not his grandson, and he granted the pictures.
So you you became interested in owning and training at some point? What sparked that?
I know it was the year 1990. I met my lifetime partner, Susan Pittman, who was a very horsey girl. And she loved riding horses. And I saw her riding. I said, I wouldn't mind having a go at this. I've never really ridden a horse, apart from the donkeys on Paignton Beach. And I said, why don't we buy one? So we went up to Ascot Sales and bought a horse called Sagart Arun as an ex, I think it a chap called Brennan used to train it in the Midlands. And it had about 30 races and never won a race. So we thought, it's a 10-year-old, but, or maybe an 11. But it's shown a bit of form. I thought, well, this is a bit of fun, you know. So we got it home and she was riding it and I started riding it and got run away with a few times. But I started getting quite serious about it. And we did this for a while. And that first year, we managed to win a race with it. It was a very, very bad race. And I remember seeing Martin Pipe at Chepstow. Actually, he had, what was the comedian called, Freddie Starr with him, as it happened. It was at Chepstow, and he said, your horse won a race then, and I thought, how did you know that? You know, it won a race at somewhere down in the depths of Cornwall or something. I said, yeah, the horse is useless, Martin. He said, no, I'll win with it. I said, you won't win with this. He said, yeah, I'll win with it. I said, yeah, okay, have it. This is in the summer, I mean, it was the end of the point-to-point season, and so we had it, and then August Bank Holiday Monday. I don't know if that picture, I don't know if you can see that picture there, but anyway, that's the winning enclosure with Peter Scudamore and Susan and myself leading it in. It was a three-horse race, and two of them fell, and he was the only survivor. And I think the prize money was about $5,000. Really much better than it is today. Jammy win, but the horse looked really well, and he was certain it was going to win anyway.
Did you have any others in training with Martin?
No, that was the only one. But then we decided to we got more and more serious, and then we decided to rent some stables out near South Brent, which is near Dartmoor, and we bought two more horses. One was called it was an unraced mare called we called her Sunny. She was by Sunny Boy, and we called her Shamafil, which was named after our three kids, Sharon, Mark and Philip. And she went on to win some nice races, but the best one we bought was called Holy Foley. He was from Ascot Sales, £1,000. He was previously trained by a lady called Jane Pilkington, who was famous for training Willie Wumpkins, who won three times at the Cheltenham Festival. And the horse didn't look very good. It had a big scar down his front. And she said, best of luck if you buy him at the auction. She said, he's a nice horse, but I can't do any more with him. So we took him back to the yard, and we shared the yard then with David and Claire Wanacott, who are the parents of Millie, who incidentally is going to go places. She's great value for a £7 claim. So anyway, we got working on this. So I rode him every day, and then we did one gallop at Neil Koenig, who's an ex-trainer jockey. It's gallop over 6 or 7 furlongs, and I think I was probably giving away 2 stone to these other two horses of ours, who were not bad, they were all right, ridden by professional jockeys, or at least point-to-point jockeys. And I was riding this Holy Foley, and he spun around at the start, and they went about 10 lengths clear, and then I gradually cruised up, and when I went up to them, I went... And he sped right away from them, like, you know, and I thought, and I come back and I was grinning all over the place. And I said to Susan, I said, I think we got something here. We got something. And he turned out to be a very good horse.
So you mentioned point-to-points.
Yeah.
So you used to bet at the point-to-points as well. Did you start getting on at them around the same time as you got in racecourse pitches?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I started at the points in about 1971, the first one I ever bet at a place called Fortress Cross in near Newton Abbot. So I've been really doing them since the very early days.
Now, doing my research, you actually made the Racing Post and a bank holiday meeting, I think it was Eggersford, for you bet no finishers. And it all went a bit
clever Dickie me, thinking, I said to the people that work for me, well, I've never ever seen no finishers. I think there was a 3 runners or 2, I can't remember now. I think there was 2 runners, and even though there was only two runners, I thought, I've never seen no finishers. Somebody always, because you could remount in those days. So I think I may have won 50-1, which is a complete idiot. And of course, people were piling in. I mean, they were having a lot on, obviously, you know, quid, £2, £3. Anyway, you know, the inevitable happened. And I think one of them was left on his own with about two fences to go. And it was ridden by a chap called Philip Schofield. He was a champion point-to-point rider, the father of Nicholas Schofield. And he fell at the last or the second last. And I went out and I said, for Christ's sake, Phil, get up, will you? Save me a bundle. I can't. He said, I've broken my arm. So yeah, and they announced it over the tannoy. The very generous bookmakers paying out everyone. And they all got paid. And they were some happy punters. Mistake, a big mistake.
Well, another day that was a clobbering for most bookmakers was... Frankie's Magnificent Seven. You were in attendance there.
Yes, I was. Yeah, I was at September 96. Never to be forgotten. Fantastic. I think what happened is that the last winner was in the Racing Post or the Sporting Life at the time was about 10 or 12 to 1. And because he'd had the previous six, I thought it's never going to be this price. So I think I put it in about 4 to 1. And I got knocked over. And everyone got knocked over. And I can't remember what it ended up at. Was it a 7-4, 2-1 chance? And I took the view that, you know, this should be a 10-1 chance, so I'll stand it for the maximum, which a few other bookmakers did to their cost. But I had enough to pay out. I mean, I always had enough readies to pay out. But I've got to be honest with you, it was a great day for racing. We still talk about it today. And I cheered him home. You know, that was fantastic. You know, Frankie riding seven winners, fabulous.
Now, finally, for this bit, there was something in the extended supplementary list, which probably wouldn't mean a lot to punters watching it, but it came in to force on the race course, which not only finished probably a lot of bookmakers, but it also finished your training career. Just can you explain a bit about the ESL?
Yeah, well, the training career, training race horses, horses go wrong, etc. You need a lot of money. I mean, the bookmaking, I was earning good money in those days, to be fair. And it was subsidising the horse training. And when the extended supplementary list came in, which meant that up until then, there were certain, when clashing meetings, the pitches were never filled up. But with the extended supplementary list, and there was a lot of pressure from the waiting list saying there's empty pitches there, why can't we fill them when there's a Fontwell and there's a Newbury and a Ascot on? So after a lot of pressure, I mean, people didn't want to give way, but eventually it all happened. And of course, instead of having sort of 12 bookmakers at a Newton Abbott Boxing Day with Wyn Canton on, there was 25 there. Well, it obviously affected the business massively. And yeah, I mean, it virtually overnight cut the profits by 50%. Yeah.
Okay, you mentioned we mentioned briefly the extended supplementary list. A lot of stuff was going on around that point with the politics of bookmaking, buying and selling pitches, boards on rails, etc. And you were involved in a lot of the discussions and the really, how frustrating was it trying to get bookmakers to agree on anything?
Oh, the bookmakers never agree on anything. I mean, they're notorious for it. You try and get a bunch of bookmakers together and they'll all have different views and different opinions. So that was impossible. But the boards on rails, for instance, which transformed the rails business. I remember the chairman of the levy board at the time, I think it was called Sir John Sparrow. And he was asked, and it's on film somewhere, you know, when do you think boards on rails? He said, not in the foreseeable future. And that was, I think it was quoted again by Rodney Bracker, who was chairman of the levy board. It may have been Rodney Bracker who said it, but Sir John Sparrow was something to do with it. So people thought, well, that's okay, then, you know, we'll carry on as we are. And I think within 6 months, there were boards on rails. And then was it the buying and selling came in right after that? I think it was.
I think it came in before.
It came in before. So all of a sudden the rails pitches were worth a lot of money. And there was a few people who bought early days and they did very well out of them. Yeah.
So how did the buying and selling, was there a mass exodus of the old school when the buying and selling came?
Yeah,
in?
There certainly was. I think the first ever auction was at Sandown Park, and I went along with Joan Redfern, who was the proprietor. Her husband, late husband Bernard, had passed away, and she took over the pitches. And she never really was into it, but they were good pitches, and she went along with Anthea Redfern, who was famous for being Bruce Forsyth's wife, and didn't have a clue. And I said, "Well, come along with me, and we'll see how it all." And it was Doncaster Bloodstock, Henry Beebe, who professionally did the auction. Anyway, she put her pictures in a bunch lot. Like, there was Newbury, there was Ascot, there was Newton, there was Exeter, there was Taunton. And she said, "What do you think I'll get, dear?" And I said, "I've got no idea. That's all we can do is gauge on what the others are going for," because it wasn't one of the first ones. And I think it got up to about 125,000. I said, "I think you've done all right. You know, I think in future years it would have got more, but who knows at the time."
So what sort of people were buying in? I mean, were they established bookmakers or people that thought it was easy?
There's a few that are still going now. I mean, just off the top of my head, I mean, West End Racing, they bought a lot of my pictures that I didn't want. The Southampton-based firm, and they're still going. So they were established off-course, and there was a number of off-course firms that bought in. But there was an awful lot of them came in who didn't have a clue, and they soon went. They just didn't operate that long.
And how did it affect the sort of the way it worked? Were there any sort of changes? Because I remember there used to be a seniority list, that sort of thing. Did that all change?
Yeah,
in the old school?
That's originally there was a list made out. The number where you were. It was all done by a committee. There was a lot of problems over that with the away bookmakers. Where did they stand? Because there used to be specific away, but only on away meetings, and they didn't. They had seniority, but they were aggrieved by the outcome anyway. Let's put it that way. But I know I wasn't on that committee to do it. I mean, I was out of it, and I ended up with sort of middle of the road pitches. There was an awful lot of problems. But originally they kept, if you bought, say, number 10 at Ascot, that would be your number. But you had no seniority. So somebody like myself, who had probably a lot of seniority, if there was gaps in front of that, I would move up and go in front of them. And that didn't go down well. So I think within about 12 months, they said there's no seniority involved. It's just whatever number you are and you move up. And that's the way it is to this day.
Okay, there's a lot of things that carried on after that that affected the betting ring. One of the first ones was bookmakers using computers. Now, you were one of the pioneers of that. I mean, I think probably the second bookmaker after John Lovell to get one.
That's correct, yeah. I mean, John Lovell, lovely late John Lovell, smashing bloke. We sent him, the NAB, that's National Association of Bookmakers, he was one of our directors. We sent him off to Australia to look at how it was done over there. And he came back and said, yeah, this is the way forward. He set one up, and he had his little Welsh team around him. And there was a Welsh firm that started it. I can't remember what they were called. But we set up with just an ordinary keyboard, not a specialised keyboard like they are now. And big car batteries. And I think the first meeting we ever went to was Bath. And I was standing them for grands, monkeys at least, you know, like, because it was complete haywire. And I think got away with it. But in the early days, the computers were just like going wrong until you got on top of them. And it was a boom, and it was a bonus. And the thing is, in this business, the bookmaking on course, it's always about getting an edge. And computers in the early days, you definitely had an edge with the people. That there was an example in the early days. One of our ex-directors on the NAB was called Mel Jones from Wales. And he said, there's no way that a computer can do bets quicker than my fastest clerk can. And they actually had a test, and the computer left him miles behind, you know. So they gradually got persuaded that was the future.
Yeah, the punters like to see on the ticket what they could win and what they backed.
Well, it's hard to believe now that you gave a ticket out with three numbers on it and your name, and the clerk would put it in the £6 to forward down to ticket 32. But no recognition of what the bet was or anything. So the punter away went with this ticket. And of course, a lot of them used to look at it, especially the younger generation. What does it mean, you know? And it could lead to massive problems. Somebody says they bet 20 quid each way and you've got it down in the book on a busy day at 20 quid win. Who was right? Then we brought out recorders, little mini recorders to listen to the bets. With all the racket going on in the race course and it held all your business up while you were doing it. And yeah, you were wrong. It was a nightmare. So these computers with all your itemised stuff, it was just fantastic.
So long did you keep the edge before they'd all cottoned on?
Well, I think one of the days I remember was at Cheltenham. And I had a very good pitch there at the Guinness Village. And I turned up there and I looked in the gear and there was no printer. I thought, oh God, I left it behind. I thought, what am I going to do? And one of my staff drove back to Taunton. And I've got Susan to drive up to Taunton from Torquay to bring this lost component. And I think one of my competitors, who was a very good friend of mine, Jack Lynn and Roy Lynn, spotted it and said, Christ, he's gone back all that way to get this. And I used to say to them, although they were friends, we were competitors. And he'd say, what's it like? I say, probably wouldn't suit you, Roy, probably wouldn't suit you. And this day, that was it then. He said, if he's gone back that far to get this printer, that's got to be the way forward. And it was.
Now, as well as being a bookmaker, you're also a magistrate.
Yeah, I mean, I think probably because I've been on all these appeals at the National Association of Bookmakers, I got into the sort of legal. I was quite interested in the legal side of things, so I applied myself to become a magistrate. I think they put an advert in the paper. We're looking for new magistrates, younger generation. And I applied, and I had to go through tough interviews to do that. And there was just a bit like the bookmakers' interviews. They were all around a table. And they would try and suss out what sort of character you were. They would put an almost impossible question, like, oh, there's a single mother with three kids who've stolen a loaf of bread and groceries, but it's the third time she's done it in a month. What would you do with her? And if anyone come out and say, oh, Christ, chuck her in jail, bung away the key, she can't keep getting away with this. They didn't want to hear that. You've got to be a fair-minded person. And but one of the things that was a bit humorous that they said, well, what odds do you think you are about getting this role as a magistrate? I said, probably about tips on, I think. Tips on? Yeah. So, and yeah, I served for 17 years, and part of that as the chairman of the bench, which is the three of you, the one in the middle, I will send you down for 6 months custody. Da, da, da.
Did any of your former, in inverted commas, customers do a double take when they got to the
race course? Funnily enough, I had a jockey came in, actually, who got a bit naughty at something. Nothing to do with racing, actually. And I said, and he'd just ridden the winner the day before at Exeter. And I said, what are you doing? I said, you've just ridden a winner. The future's in front of you. You keep your nose clean. And he's still riding in the point-to-points today, actually.
And we can't talk to you without mentioning the fact that you were the chairman of Torquay United.
Yeah, well, I nearly played for them. I remember the manager coming to my door one day when I was about 17. They wanted to take me on as a trialist up there and whatnot. And I broke my ankle or something the next day, so it never happened. It's all about timing. But I've always been a fan of Torquay United, and they got into big financial difficulties, and I think 2015, and the current directors had enough. They'd run out of their money. So four of us went in and put some money in, and basically the club survived. And I did it for a couple of years, and it was really interesting. I mean, I used to go all the away trips. Some of the away trips were like Barrow and Hartlepool and Gateshead. Not nice, you know, coming back on a Saturday night and you've lost 1-0. But yeah, I enjoyed it, and it was only a temporary thing. But funnily enough, a firm called Gaming International have taken over the club, who operate greyhound tracks at Reading and Swindon, I think.
Okay, so we've mentioned before that you were a pioneer of the bookmaking. Started with a lot of things, including the computers. Future of the betting rings looking a bit dicey at the moment. What would be your next move as a bookmaker?
Well, I've only got probably excuse me, I've probably only got about 5 or 6 pictures left now, so I'm sort of semi-retired. But the future, I'd love to say it's promising, but I'm really concerned with it for anybody who's in the business, because they're talking about cashless, it seems to be the operative word. It's just not going to work with racecourse bookmakers, or even the tote on the racecourse. I mean, people turn up on a racecourse, if it's cashless, what's the incentive to bet with the bookmakers or the tote? Well, they can do it on the phone. It's no difference. I think it's very, very worrying. And really, and people like cash. People like to draw their winnings and count it out. It's just part of the enjoyment of the day, the colour of the excitement. It'd be very, very sad if it ever comes in. I'd be extremely worried about the future.
So what would you suggest to the bookmakers that are sort of looking at doing a career for the next 20 years?
Well, I mean, that's one thing that's you know, cash is king. It's got to stay. And I mean, the NAB, we've had meetings about this, and I'm still on the director of the NAB, and we cannot lose this battle, because the older generation, the big race goers, they love cash. A lot of them haven't got a credit card or a debit card. And the bookmaker's going to have to get their act together and persuade. And it's just the tote as well. It's not only bookmakers, the tote are going to be affected by this as well.
And would 20 years' time, are there going to be racecourse bookies?
Well, I won't be around, Simon, but yeah, I hope so. It's all part of the excitement and the racecourse and the colour of the ring, so we need to keep going.
Brilliant. Well, Dave Phillips, thanks very much for talking to us.
You're quite welcome.
Johnny Ward presents The Front Runner in association with starsports.bet. 18 and over. Be gamble aware.